This is Talk is Cheap on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. Also streaming online at KEPW.org, where you can donate if you want. All right, so what this is from last year's crime report, thecrimereport.com, or .org, is the Guggenheim Symposium in March of 2021 on progressive prosecutors. Can progressive prosecutors make a difference? Part 2. Hosted by Marissa Bluestein from the Center for Fair Administration of Justice, featuring John Chisholm, District Attorney of Milwaukee, Miriam Krinsky of Fair and Just Prosecution, San Francisco District Attorney Chasia Bowden, and a public defender named Darcy Calvert. All right, so that's coming up here on KPW, LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kpw.org. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
In real life.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess there's a lot to respond to. Let me share, if I can, I'm trying to get it, a report that's really topical in response to some of the points Darcy was making, that we put out, kind of looking at how we had reduced the jail population. And I didn't hear the percentage Darcy said. I guess it was taken from the Vera Institute, but I think it's pretty far off the actual numbers. And maybe that's just a question of, you know, what their starting point was and what their ending point was. That's the nature of statistics. But when I took office in January of 2020, our jail population peaked that month around 1,250 human beings in the jail. And at its trough, in kind of late spring, early summer during the pandemic, we got below 700. We've stabilized in the high 700s. We're currently around 775. So, you know, depending on how you measure it, it's much more like a 40% drop. But I think one of the other things that's important to think about, you know, particularly as I hear some of the criticisms of folks like Larry Krasner and Kim Fox and others who are colleagues of ours, is to remember that, you know, as much as people like to emphasize the tremendous power that prosecutors have, and we do, we don't operate in a vacuum. And one of the things that drives the jail population far more than any decision that I make is police practices. How many people are being brought to the jail every day? And court practices. How quickly are the judges releasing people? We have some cases where we ask for people to be released and the court disagrees and sets bail, even though we object as a matter of policy to any use of money bail. Right? That's a policy I put in place my first week in office. We will not ever sit by and watch the court use wealth as a proxy for incarceration. And yet the court does it sometimes. And similarly, there are cases where we ask the court to detain someone because we believe they are a public safety risk that can't be mitigated by non-monetary conditions, and the court may disagree and not release people. So, you know, we, as much as folks like to focus on prosecutors as a uniquely powerful entity within the broader criminal legal system, it's also true, as in every other area of government life, that there are checks and balances on our power. And I think that also dovetails with a point that Darcy makes in her article, you know, and something that, frankly, I didn't fully appreciate myself when I was a public defender for many years, until, you know, I had to actually start dealing with the budget process as a department head. But I would love if all of the money that is going into the war on drugs instead went into a public health approach to battling addiction. But I don't control the budget. In fact, I don't have any control over the budget. The mayor and the board of supervisors control the budget in San Francisco and in most jurisdictions. And so it's not as simple as saying, well, we'll give up resources or get out of the way, as one of the panelists said, and then we get to control where the resources go. The problem is we are dealing with a world in which if I get out of the way and stop prosecuting the drug cases that I know are ineffective as a response to the really serious challenges we have with overdose fatalities and with addiction, then what happens in a practical matter is not that that money gets given to public health services or harm reduction or safe consumption sites. As a practical matter, the U.S. attorney starts prosecuting people for the same exact cases. And the U.S. attorney cooperates with ICE, and those people get deported, which they wouldn't if I were the one prosecuting them. And those people don't get access to drug treatment programs or our drug court, which they will if I'm the one prosecuting people who have substance use disorders. So it is a much more complicated terrain when you're in this seat than I think in an idealistic world it would be from the outside. And I have defense attorneys who practice in federal court in some cases calling me and begging me not to stop prosecuting drug cases. And it seems counterintuitive when you're in the standpoint of a public defender. When I was a public defender for many years, wouldn't have anticipated that. But when the alternative is a Trump administration U.S. attorney doing drug sweeps in poor neighborhoods and detaining people pre-trial and then handing them over to ICE, that's a really, really stark alternative. It's a dire one for the people. And it's not that my office prosecuting them is somehow good or benevolent. No one wants to be prosecuted, of course. But the alternative isn't this sort of idealized, well, I can give up my budget and then we'll have, all the public health programming that John mentioned, you know, this country is systematically underfunded. The alternative is often something far worse. And so I think the work of public defenders and of criminal justice reform advocates and of progressive prosecutors is to build those alternatives. But we're flying an airplane and we're trying to build an alternative in midair. And so getting out of the way when you're dealing with, for example, people who repeatedly commit acts of violence against vulnerable elders, getting out of the way is complicated. You know, we don't need to think that jail or prison is a good solution. But until we have a good solution, I'm not going to simply say, well, because I don't like jail and prison, I'm going to stand by and watch while people who engage in repeated acts of violence continue to do that. We can't. That's not our job. That's not what we're elected to do. It's not the role that we have to play when it comes to public safety. And I appreciate when public defenders do get engaged and say, hey, this is based on trauma, and this is based on a history of mental illness, and this is based on someone being unhoused, and all those things that are really important context that as prosecutors we don't have the luxury of necessarily knowing without collaborative and sometimes adversarial public defenders giving us that information. That information informs the decisions we make. But until we have, not necessarily from us, but until we as a society have effective ways to respond to violence in particular, we need to figure out how we can intervene in ways that minimize harm, but also engage people who feel under attack, who feel that they are unsafe in their own neighborhoods, their own homes, their own communities, and that make clear that there are consequences and there is accountability when you cause harm in the community. What that accountability looks like, I think, as Danielle Surrett writes really eloquently about, in her book, that accountability should be and must be more complicated than simply punishment. And I think one of the fundamental problems with how so many in the media and in the public think about and understand criminal justice, how they understand accountability, is as narrowly defined as punishment. And the more we punish people, the more we're holding them accountable. But that's not true, right? Danielle Surrett explains, I think, it's something I saw through my parents' decades in prison. My father's pushing on closing his fourth decade in prison now. He's been in for 39 years. And as difficult as that length of incarceration is, as difficult as any period of incarceration is, it's possible to simply and passively accept it. What's harder, what's more challenging, what's more transformative is being held accountable in ways that directly engage with the people whose lives the crime harmed. And so when one of the victims of my father's crime went to visit him in his prison, when he came face to face with her and understood from seeing her humanity and hearing her story the harm that his crime caused, it did more for his understanding and for his compassion and for his remorse than any number of decades in a cage could do. And our system is sadly really devoid of that kind of meaningful accountability, of that kind of transformative justice. So I think we need more of it, and we need people in our communities, the people who elect us and re-elect us, hopefully, to appreciate that restorative justice can be far more powerful of a tool to hold folks who caused harm accountable, and far more effective of a tool to uplift and heal victims who've been harmed than simply imposing arbitrary numbers of years of punishment.
Thank you. And Miriam, I would appreciate if you could kind of pick up on that thread. I mean, from the national perspective that you have, in terms of when we talk about accomplishments of prosecutors' offices and where they've gone, have progressive prosecutors moved that discussion at all away from carceral communities as the answer for holding people accountable? Are we having broader discussions now incorporating restorative justice values or other non-incarceration means of accountability? And where do you see that those accomplishments is moving forward?
Yeah, no, great question. And I think, in some ways, just the fact that we're having this conversation, just the fact that Danielle did write a book and people are consuming it and understanding those notions that how we truly heal victims and survivors, how we heal communities, how we enable individuals who have done wrong to be held accountable and understand the nature of what they did and the impact that it had on others. I think that is starting to spread, and we are starting to see an awakening to the need to think about these things differently and to change the pre-existing paradigms, and certainly to move away, as data shows us, the dramatic extent of its failures from practices in the 80s and the 90s and the heyday of tough on crime. I think we saw through efforts of our prior federal administration and federal leaders, our prior president, our prior attorney general over the last 4 years, to resurrect a bit of that tough on crime thinking and narrative. And the refusal through polling and other evidence that we saw at the polling booth as well, of members of our communities to embrace it, to be fooled by it, to presume that that narrative aligned with facts. I think that's telling. And when you look at the national picture, we obviously know that there are over 2,400 elected local prosecutors in the country. And so someone might look at that and say, so what difference really can a few dozen or close to 100 more reform-minded elected prosecutors make? But when we drill into that data, we see a couple of things. First of all, we know that around a quarter of our nation's jail population resides in just 35 prosecutorial districts. So if you could change the way those 35 prosecutorial districts think about the job that they do, you have impacted a quarter of our jails population in this country. We know, and this is from great work that Professor Carissa Hessick in North Carolina did, that if you change just 148 prosecutorial leaders, you can impact over 50% of the jail population. And Carissa and I wrote an op-ed that looked at some of those figures. So I think the other thing we have to realize is, in terms of reflecting on the national change, is the fact that as of just a few years ago, only 1% of elected prosecutors were Black females. As of just a few years ago, 95% of incumbent elected prosecutors, sorry, John and Jasa, were reelected, and 85% of the time, they weren't even challenged. There wasn't even a conversation in the community about the job they were doing, about the standards we were holding to, about the nature and metrics and vision of our criminal legal system that we wanted to see them perpetuate. So scrolling forward, what we now know is that is no longer the norm. We are seeing increasing numbers of women and women of color elected to these offices. Sadly, they are receiving a harsher degree of pushback than any other elected prosecutors almost in the nation. We also know that these races are being paid attention to, that incumbents are no longer feeling that they hold the job for life, that the conversations are happening, and that individuals like Chesa or Mary Krasner, as was mentioned in the questions in Philadelphia, Rachel Rollins in Boston, most recently in Los Angeles, were guest runners. They are running, they are winning, and in many instances, they are being incumbents in those challenges. We know that in the last election, in November of last year, that reform-minded new prosecutors were elected in jurisdictions that represent over 20% of our nation's population. So I think when we look at that, what we see is that these changes are here to stay. They're here to stay, and they're here to stay in the face and in the hands of individuals who, with the stroke of a pen, can from day one make the kinds of changes that are incredibly significant that we saw George Gascon make the day he assumed office and was sworn in. With the stroke of a pen, they can say, no longer will this jurisdiction seek the death penalty. No longer will we charge kids in adult court. No longer will we be seeking sentencing enhancements, three strikes, or the sorts of things like mandatory minimums that ramped up mass incarceration. These changes are huge. And so they really do have the ability to effectuate change, but we also know that those changes are only going to be as good as the weakest link in the system, and that we have to be looking beyond elected prosecutors. As was mentioned, we have to look at police and leaders, and actually we are seeing reform-minded sheriffs elected in various parts of the country. We have to look at judges, and we are seeing, as reflected in one of the questions, some reform-minded judges running on an agenda of change and being elected. We know that they have to be able, and a question asked about this, and perhaps we'll have a chance to dwell on it, to change the culture in their own office. Change is only as deep as that weakest link in the office. So you can change it from the top down, but until you start to change these offices from the bottom up as well, policies may only live on paper. And implementation is going to be critical if we're truly looking to turn many of these large shifts.
Thank you, Miriam. And I want to, again, kind of use that to move forward a bit, yes, to talk about this issue of pushback, right? So there have been some questions in the Q&A, both about pushback from outside the office, from legislators or judges or even for law enforcement, but also that issue of the culture within. That we've seen in so many offices. I mean, we've seen it, I live in Philadelphia, we see it here in Philadelphia, where the line VA is actually pushed back against some of the changes that the line cross, that the elected wants to make. And I want to kind of focus that back to John and Chesa in terms of your experiences. You know, what kinds of systemic pushback have you seen both from outside the office and from within? And how have you had to kind of deal with that to be able to either convince people that you're right, and that your policies are good for the community and strengthen the community, or have you had to modify in order to kind of make sure the system is still flowing? I'll ask John for that first and then Chase.
Sorry about that. So I was really fortunate in the sense that I had an office that had a culture that had been told from day one when he entered the office is that your job was to do justice, that we didn't count victories, we didn't count losses, we counted doing things to the best of our ability the right way. So I was fortunate with having an internal culture that valued the ethic of just doing the best you possibly could, and not looking on this and just understanding that you were dealing with real victims, real defendants, real people, and addressing them that way. I was also fortunate because as I engaged in this process, I was supported by, you know, people are afraid sometimes to bring outside people in to look at your operations. it turned out to be the exact opposite for me. By bringing outside entities in who wanted to work with us in good faith, they did two things. They actually worked with the people in our office to explain, for example, why are we going to study ourselves as it relates to the live wire issue of race? What if the results are that it looks really bad? You know, and that frightens people. Look, I'm not a racist. You know, when I make these decisions, I'm not intentionally doing anything like that. And just having people be able to come in and explain that that's not the point. The point is we want to look at this to find out if, in fact, in the aggregate, we're doing something that is just impacting in a disparate, unfair way. And then we get to do something about it, right? Then, okay, we're going to change policies. We're going to change practices. We're going to do something about it. The exact same thing had to be done with the community. And the advantage I had is I was able, in my first election, I was able to walk out with a guy named Wayne McKenzie, who was an experienced deputy DA from the Brooklyn DA's office, who was on loan with the Vera Institute. And he went to the community with me and said, hey, look, this guy's willing to do this. And, you know, this is potentially going to come up with some information that might not look good. Are you going to give him a chance? Are you actually going to allow him to objectively look at it and then solve the problem? So that's the approach that we've always taken. I just believe strongly that people get into public service, whether you're a public defender, a prosecutor, your motivations should be the same, right? You want to make your community a better place. And so you attract people that understand that there's going to be sacrifices that come along with that, but then you also have to lead them. You have to lead them, you have to engage with them, you have to listen to them, and then you have to do the same thing with the community. When the community is telling you things, you have to just be willing to listen to them, to engage with them, and sometimes it's very, very uncomfortable, unpleasant, and sometimes you're going to feel it's unfair because the information sometimes isn't, you know, it's so hard to overcome some of the false information, and more importantly, it's hard to overcome a historical narrative that's based on very true lived experiences, right? That distrust isn't a phantom. It's based on real lived experience. So that's what you're confronting each and every day to try to make sure that ultimately you change a culture, right? You change the culture within your office, but you're also trying to change the culture of the office's relationship with the community.
And Chesa, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, similar to John, I had the benefit of coming into an office that had, a history of reform-minded leadership and that had already begun to lay the groundwork and build a foundation for a lot of the changes that I wanted to accelerate. And that definitely helped. But there was also a need to make change and to show that we would be aggressive in fulfilling the promises I was elected on. And change is hard. You know, these are big bureaucratic institutions, and they have cultures, and they have people who've been there for, in some cases, 30, 40 years. And the people in our office, no matter how much, they may, agree or disagree with a particular policy, and this is true in all of our offices, these are people who believe that they are doing good work for their communities. They took these jobs not because they wanted to accelerate racial disparities or because they thought that they were going to destroy black and brown communities. They took these jobs because of their perception of how they could make a contribution. They to become a public defender or a district attorney, you are foregoing opportunities to make more money at a place like Goldman Sachs or McKinsey or a big law firm, right? And those are opportunities that are available to most of the people in our offices, and yet they choose to go into government service. And so when someone gets elected, like me or John or George or Kim or Larry, and they come in and they say, hey, what you've been doing for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years is actually causing more harm than it's helping, that's a really difficult thing for people to hear, and they resist that. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to believe that for their entire life, their entire career, they've been doing harm. And they don't want to believe that an outsider like me, a career public defender, knows better than they do how to be a prosecutor or how to be a prosecutor that helps promote public safety. So, yeah, those changes inevitably lead to some pushback. And what it looks like really depends on a lot of in the weeds issues. You know, in LA, George Gascon is dealing with not just the biggest office in terms of the number of attorneys in the country, but also an office where the individual attorneys have civil service protections. And that not only ties his hands in terms of accelerating the change, but it emboldens the resistance that he faces from rank and file. In other offices, people may be at will employees, and so where they may be smaller and easier to manage. You know, in my office, it's a mid-size office. We have about 300 staff, but it's small enough that I can allow for exceptions to my policies, and I can personally oversee and decide when to make exceptions. You probably can't do that in an office as big as LA. And so there's a lot of, I think, you know, really detail-oriented in-the-weeds decisions that have to be made about how we're going to accelerate the change that we were elected to bring about based on the, you know, labor issues, the framework you're inheriting, the particular local policies, how many courthouses you have. Those kinds of things make a really big difference from a technical standpoint of, like, how do you go about managing and leading change? So there's not a one-size-fits-all solution, but you're absolutely going to see resistance from within these offices, even from people who are truly dedicated to a common vision of public safety and racial equity, because people have dedicated their careers to it, and it's hard to change their minds. It's hard for someone to recognize or accept that what they've been doing may be hurting more than it's helping.
And I think I want to kind of also address some of the questions on the Q&A about where the political angle for this comes in. So one of the questions is just about, you know, by focusing in on a district attorney's office as the kind of bearer of criminal justice reform, you know, how does that impact, you know, does that hamper the movement, if you will, you know, given the political pendulums that we often see? Right? Of course, we see prosecutors come in on a wave of reform, and then sometimes we see that backlash from the voters about, no, we want to try to kind of move it backwards. And I want to kind of bring Darcy and Miriam into the issue, this question here, particularly Darcy, from one who is in court having to deal with some of these things that kind of can implicate a public defender's client. You know, is there some concern that by putting the onus behind the district attorneys to make change, that pendulum could swing back and harm clients or others in the criminal legal system?
So thanks for asking that, because I think that's a really important question and drives much of my sentiment around what kind of change we need. Kind of implicit in your question is the reality that, lower crime rates have really created space in the kind of public imagination for this movement. But, you know, that could turn on a dime and things could go back the other way. And so I would say, first in thinking about how, much of the progressive prosecutor movement is kind of implemented through internal policies, you know, that's concerning to me, because those policies can be, done away with the stroke of a pen if these district attorneys are replaced. And not only that, but in thinking about, as many people on this panel have mentioned, you know, pushback from line prosecutors who are basically just ignoring policies handed down by their bosses. These internal policies are not judicially enforceable. So if you're a public defender, you know the prosecutor, in court that day is not following office policy, you know, what are you going to do about that? You can't appeal to the judge. And then second, this is very much why I think we need kind of structural reform, you know, moving power and resources away from these offices. And I certainly don't mean to suggest that that is easy. As Chase has pointed out, you know, these decisions involve several institutions. In many cases, prosecutors are not the ones, you know, ultimately making the decisions. But I do think that there's a long history of prosecutors opposing legislative and judicial reform, taking funds away from their offices. And Miriam's article that recognizes the importance of, you know, leaving district attorney associations, which have been very much the kind of organizing point for these resistance kind of efforts, go a long way to that. And so really, I think that supporting this change, understanding, of course, that prosecutors are not the only ones making decisions, so that, you know, if these district attorneys are replaced, we're not seeing the kind of reallocation of these things towards, you know, going back to the way things used to be. I think that, you know, that's very much why I think kind of really structural change is a big part of what we need to maximize the impact that this movement could have.
And Miriam, you spoke before about the kind of staying power, if you will, about progressive prosecutors kind of surviving challenges from the political, you know, whims. How do you see that this impacting the kind of things that the prosecutors are trying to implement? You know, are they at risk of being undone if it's not a broader political movement?
I think that we have seen tremendous opposition and attempts to unseat some of the individuals who came into office in 2016 and put massive changes into place over the course of their tenure. We saw a number of groups and individuals try to unseat Kim Gardner in St. Louis. We saw some money from police unions and others in that race invested in the race in Kansas City, Kansas, in Wyandotte County, as I mentioned earlier, in regard to Mark Dupree's race, obviously in Chicago, in relation to King Fox. All of those individuals were reelected. So, yes, we see the pushback, but we haven't yet seen the pushback succeed. And I think we should be heartened by that, because as we think about that question that you asked, Marissa, the swinging pendulum, I completely agree with Dorsey that the ideal is to hardwire change, to not enable things to revert backward. But the way we get there, in my mind, is by trying to support leaders like Chesa, like John, and others who are willing to show the value of that change, and to have data and researchers and others be able to underscore and prove the concept. So first we need to dip our toe into the sort of stream of change and be able to convince people, including voters, that those changes work, and then hopefully see those changes become part of the fabric of our legal structure, and those voters understand and engage in those races. And again, I think we should be heartened by the fact that this so-called movement, it's growing in number. It is becoming a new normal. It is threatening state associations. And we are seeing, as Jason knows well, in California, the formation of an alternative voice of elected prosecutors in the state. We've seen that happen in Virginia as well, where a group of more reform-minded Commonwealth's attorneys came together, supported a variety of reforms, and now Virginia is the first state in the old Confederacy on the verge of eliminating the death penalty. Their governor is about to sign that into law, and that's huge. And in part, that was with the voice of so-called progressive prosecutors coming together to support that change on an exact issue where traditionally state associations have been the ones for decades who have stood in the way of those changes and so many other public in our criminal justice system. So I think we have to recognize that things are changing. There is a new normal that's setting in, and voters increasingly are going down ballot to engage and vote in these races. Even that statistic alone, the fact that more voters are choosing to exercise voice on these issues, reflects the fact that they're coming to understand the clout of these positions. And increasingly, they're exercising their voice to say that they've had enough. They don't want to keep doing what we've done for decades. They've seen the spread, they've been impacted by it, and they know it doesn't work, and they don't want to keep wasting lives and wasting money.
And I think, Chase, I know you have to leave us, so I want to make sure that There's a question in the panel and the Q&A back at directly on this point about kind of political wins, if you will, that given the election margin that you had with so many people in the race, do you have a concern about re-election and if this becomes an issue, and if you will, as in the Q&A, a political football in San Francisco, as you have to face your re-election? And then, of course, any parting words you want to leave us with before we have to say goodbye?
Sure. I mean, look, any elected official, by definition, has to be concerned about their re-election. No matter how many terms you've been in office, no matter how big your margin of victory, that's the beauty of democracy, right? It keeps us accountable. It keeps us thinking about responding to the needs of the people that we're, you know, privileged enough to be able to serve every day in these jobs. And frankly, it's one of the fundamental differences that I see every day in my work as district attorney compared to what I experienced when I was a public defender. You know, when you're a public defender, and I love being a public defender, I love the work that public defenders do, your ethical obligation is really narrow. It's really simple and clear. I mean, you have a client and you have to fight like heck for that client. And there's something that is really pure about that obligation, right? You know that these individuals, whether they're charged with misdemeanors and, you know, in your first couple years in the office, or whether, you know, when you move on to felonies or life cases, they depend on you. And your job, ethically, morally, your job is to fight for them and to hope for the best in the future. Meanwhile, as district attorneys, we represent indirectly the same people that the public defenders represent. They are part of the people that we represent. But we also represent the victims of their crimes. We also represent people who may read about those crimes in the news and be scared, or people who have their own experiences with perhaps negative interactions with police or the courts. And we have to find a way to do justice as we seek fair outcomes for everyone we serve. And so, yes, we think about re-election. We think about how we can both lead and also be responsive to the fears and concerns that people have in the communities we serve. And I think, you know, hopefully over time, and hopefully we in this movement have the time to allow folks to see that this is more effective, to let the data speak for itself. You know, there are, just to give you an example, going back to a point Darcy made in the very beginning about jail reduction, there are so many people in police unions, in conservative TV talk shows, who would swear to you that if you reduce the jail populations, the prison populations, crime will surge, right? Mm-hmm. They would have you believe that people who are incarcerated are all dangerous and violent. And if we don't have them behind bars, they will harm us. And what we've seen in San Francisco, and we document this in the report that I linked to earlier, is in fact the opposite. We saw a virtuous cycle where as the jail population decreased, crime rates also fell. And because police were bringing fewer people to jail, it was easier for us to focus resources on finding safe reentry for those who were still there. And in the process, we identified people who never should have been in jail in the first place. We found a woman in our jail who was pregnant, who had no criminal history, and who was serving a jail sentence on a misdemeanor. High-risk pregnancy during COVID. So we got her early released. We got her placed in a residential prenatal facility where she and the baby got the care they needed. And I'm really excited to be able to share with you that she gave birth to a healthy baby, that she stayed sober, that she has not been rearrested, that she's on her way to long-term supportive housing. Those are the kinds of outcomes that we can achieve when we have the space and the focus. And those are the kinds of virtuous cycles that we can build when we work together, when we have the space and the support from the left and the right, instead of the criticism that I think is all too often what we experience from all sides. And you know, there's a fine line between criticism and creating political space to go further and do more. But we need folks who are advocating for reform, who are advocating for us to get out of the way, to step up and build the alternatives, right? I would be happy to stop prosecuting drug cases. I would be happy to do it. But we need someone with medical experience, with budget authority, to begin building back all those institutional systems that John mentioned don't exist. We need them to exist so that we can stop doing things that we know are ineffective and harmful. And I hope that we have time to do it. I'll just end with a reflection, which is a lot of people have asked me in recent interviews, well, you've been in office 14 months now, and, you know, have you been able to accomplish your goals? And, you know, how do you judge your successes and this and that? And it's like, well, yeah, we've had a pandemic. I've barely been able to go into my office. The problems that we're trying to change and challenge took decades, if not centuries, to build up, right? We know that the issues we see are rooted in, in inequality in healthcare and housing and education and employment, and we're kind of the end of the line. And so, no, I didn't expect that I'd be able to solve all those problems in a year. Probably not even in a full term in office. These are problems that are going to take long, hard, collaborative efforts to make a noticeable difference. And I believe if we have the time and the space, then we will move towards a world where we don't need prisons or jails, whereas Angela Davis theorized many years ago where prisons may eventually be obsolete. But it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a lot of difficult decisions and a lot of hard political collaboration along the way. Hey, I'm sorry I have to leave early. I see my friend and our new state senator, Sydney Kahnblager, just joined. Really excited that she'll be our new state senator from Los Angeles. Congratulations on an absolutely huge, crushing victory. Really proud. And I know you're going to continue to advocate for the kinds of reforms and policies we've been talking about today, and that will help keep us safe in ways that don't rely on fear-mongering or more prisons to do it. Thank you, Sydney, and thank you, Marissa, all of the other panelists. Great to be with you. Sorry, I've got to jump off. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. John, I kind of want to put the, we just have a very few minutes left here, and there's a thread that Miriam kind of dropped that I'd like you to pick up, which is this issue about the district attorneys associations and their pushback. We saw, of course, George Gascon in LA, you very publicly pulled out of the California District Attorneys Association. You yourself are involved with a different type of District Attorneys Association, APA. And just wondering if you could briefly comment on that issue in terms of what you see from fellow prosecutors' associations and groupings, and kind of inter squabbles maybe that kind of come up to that. I think that's putting it a little bit too lightly, but how do you see that impacting? And then I'm going to be just asking for each of you to kind of give a couple very brief, maybe 30-second kind of wrap up. But John, if you could focus on that for a moment.
Yeah, first of all, I just want to, I'd almost rather just end on Miriam's optimistic note and touching his optimistic note as well. My caution is this, right? And that is, if I were to see, and this is just based on my experience, having been the subject of a very concerted conservative dark money campaign directed at against me, I recognize a couple dynamics that pose a significant challenge to the progressive movement. And the most basic is structural, right? And that is that the majority of our laws in most of our systems are passed by state legislators. And state legislatures are disproportionately right now controlled by people that I would argue are not particularly either informed or supportive of progressive principles. And so that in itself creates a legitimate challenge. And it goes to even to the issue of discretion, right? This has been mentioned as sort of a concern, a warning, right? And that is that when elected prosecutors engage in policy reform, the pushback can come directly from the legislature, it can come from an attorney general, it can come from the federal prosecutor if he's from aligned with a different party. So the challenges are not, it just moderates your sense that I can personally come in and change the world right here, because you're always, and this is okay. I don't say this as a downer. It's an invited response. Let's put it that way. In legal terms, an invited response means you're pushing the edge, and you're almost asking somebody to come back and rebut what you're saying very forcefully, right? So, but that's okay, because that's part of the dialectic here, right? Is that you're trying to push forward, but you're trying to do it on principled grounds, And so the only other caution I put out there is we can never, ever, ever underestimate the power of fear to create bad public policy. And we are in a time in our nation, and particularly in our communities, mine being at the forefront of this, where violence is simply overwhelming the sense of our perspective of safety. And when people do not feel safe, and I'll give you a proxy for that. I think over somewhere around the range of 20 to 25 million handguns or firearms were sold in the United States last year alone. They estimate 4.5 to 5 million new purchasers bought firearms last year. I use that as a proxy, right? I mean, that means that people have a sense of unease. They do not feel that that they're safe. And when that is amplified by false information and is deliberately manipulated, you can come up with bad policy, bad law, bad practices really quick. And so one of the things that you have to consciously and repeatedly engage in is, again, just trying to communicate through data, through stories, what is actually taking place, and take different approaches to try to prevent where you can prevent, intervene intelligently, and try to rely on suppression methods as really the last resort. I mean, that's really, but the progressive message is very difficult to get through when, like in my community, we had 191 homicides last year just in the city of Milwaukee, you know, 215 for the county. Really hard to make an argument about system reform when that's what, you know, 800 people non-fatally shot. I'm just telling you, it makes it difficult.
It does. I'm getting the wrap-up music here from the organizers, but I do want to give Miriam and Darcy a chance to kind of give a very brief wrap. You know, so where do we go from here? If you could do that in 60 seconds or less, I'd appreciate it. Miriam, then Darcy.
Yeah, so let me maybe use my 60 seconds to make a plea to those who are listening, the individuals who are telling this story, and just underscore the extent to which all of you can be part of the solution. Telling the story in a nuanced way that does not turn it into the most headline-grabbing crime of the moment, but 1,000 other cases that go well. And not letting the fear media take over. That's part of the solution, and that's how we're going to chart our way forward. So I appreciate you all again setting the table, and hope this council and FTP is here to support those efforts.
Thank you, Miriam. And Darcy, I know you said you're the wet blanket here, but I think you probably have some optimism left in you.
I was just going to say, I mean, I promised to be a downer, and I think I delivered. I like Miriam, I mean, just to say one last thing, you know, for people who are here, I think that if you're interested in understanding, you know, how progressive prosecution has kind of panned out, you know, in each of these offices, I really encourage you to talk to public defenders who interact with these prosecutors every day. Probably off the record, you may have noticed, you know, I did not talk at all about either of our two progressive prosecutors here. But I think that those individuals, particularly who were in those offices before there were progressive prosecutors, can really, you know, shed a lot of light on how things have changed or have not changed.
Great. And I just am so grateful to all of you for your time. Thank you, Stephen, for having us all and for asking me to host. This has been quite an honor, and I'm very pleased to have been here with you all today. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, you've been listening to Can Progressive Prosecutors Make a Difference? From the Crime Report, Guggenheim Symposium of March of 2021, hosted by Marissa Bluestein of Center for Fair Administration of Justice, featuring John Chisholm, District Attorney of Milwaukee, Miriam Krinsky from Fair and Just Prosecution, Public Defender Darcy Calvert, and San Francisco District Attorney Chasia Bowden. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. KPW, LP, 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio. Also streaming online at kpw.org.
the right movement to climb down with your right hand pitch. Stretch the cake conveniently available for all the kids. Following the right movement to climb down with your right hand pitch. Stretch the cake conveniently available for all the kids.
What about my crack, my smack, my bitch right here in Hollywood?
Now, like, only Americans are incarcerated in the prison system of the U.S.
Opening our hearts to the brilliance. Love is strong, hearing its loudest gunfire away. Never wrong, constantly dreaming of another way. Love is strong, go ahead and end the world with your charades. Never wrong, constantly dreaming of another way.
Could I get some more piano, please?
I do believe you are strong in forming violence. We are strong performing silence. I do believe you are strong performing violence. We are strong performing silence.
We are deceived, all the toys of our convenience. Opening our hearts to the brilliance. We are deceived, all the toys of our convenience. Opening our hearts to the brilliance. Love is strong, hearing its loudest gunfire away. Never wrong, constantly dreaming of another. Never wrong, constantly dreaming of another. Find me a red bag, one without a tag. Hope that you are near, valiantly appear. Find me a red bag.
Find me a red bag, one without a tag. Hope that you are near valiantly appear. Find me a red bag.